Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it. Hey, Emily, you are, this is the first time that you have not been sitting next to me when we've been recording this. This is kind of weird.
I know. Do you feel like a phantom me next to you right now? Because it's kind of like how I feel. I feel like you're still with me. I feel like you're here. I feel like we're together. This is still going strong. I like it.
That's a great thing about technology. But you are on the Skype call here, just like we do with our guests. What's going on? Where are you right now?
Yeah, I'm at my parents' house in upstate New York, kind of like the little sister to the Adirondacks area. It's beautiful here. Love it. We live on a Christmas tree farm, so I'm just visiting for the weekend.
That's awesome. Well, yep. we had to make sure we got this done even over Skype just now because, you're away and I'm about to head out to the Philippines. So we had to do this remote. But it's cool. It's the power of technology, right? So who are we talking to today? We have a pretty rad guest.
Oh, yeah. Colin O'Brady. He's so cool, so energetic, so inspiring. And he is just a world record crusher. So now he has 3 world records. Yeah. What is the first one he did? The name of that one is?
So it was his Beyond 7.2 project. And that was, he went and set the world record for the Explorers Grand Slam, which is doing the 7 summits and the North and South Pole. And and in doing that record, he also happened to set the speed record for the 7 summits. Just recently, that was, I think, a couple years back. And just recently, this past summer, he just crushed the record by, I think, crushed it by like over 20 days. He did it in 21 days, the highest point in every state in the United States. And that was his 50 HP project.
So cool. So cool. I was following along during that, and he talked a little bit about this effect that he wanted to have on the communities too, but people were just like coming out in droves, like coming to see him at these different states and like hiking with him and just like such a community event. It seemed so cool.
Yeah, but it was pretty rad to follow along.
Yeah, the 7 Summits thing is interesting because don't you have a cool story around some artwork around that?
Yeah. So the 7 summits, I mean, I have been on 3 of them, Denali, Aconcagua, and Kilimanjaro, and so has one of my best friends, Ethan. And when Ethan's girlfriend reached out to me this past summer because she kind of wanted to get him a birthday present / they were just moving into a new house present, and she was looking for those kind of those like vintage retro style posters that you see of like national parks and stuff. She was trying to find those for the mountains that we had been on. And that's funny because Ethan and our other friend Ryan and I had always had conversations. This goes back as far as 2013 when we were on Aconcagua. We had been dying to find those posters ourselves and could never find a cohesive set. And so we can talk about this a little bit more towards the end of the show, the whole process of actually making the set, and we're going to be giving one away. So be sure to listen through the episode, be totally inspired by Colin. I just looked it up. His world record recently was the fastest time to summit all 50 states, and it was 21 days, 9 hours, and 48 minutes, which is just crazy. So, we talked to Colin about everything from the logistics behind that project and his other project, Beyond 7.2, and his work in the nonprofit space, and how he and his wife are a logistical powerhouse to get all this done, and just like really, really cool conversation. And be sure to listen all the way to the end when I give you the rest of the story on these 7 summits posters that are finally a thing for the first time, and we're going to be giving away a set.
Woo! Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Stokecast. We've got Colin O'Brady. How you doing, man?
Good, man. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're psyched.
I had a question for you right off the bat. So just following you on Instagram, like, how do you have the energy to do all the things that you do?
Emily is wondering if you are exhausted.
Yeah.
I am exhausted. It's funny, as you are probably sure well aware, I just finished this 50 High Points World Record project, so climbed the tallest mountain in each of the 50 states. But the reason your question is very on point, which is that was obviously a challenging project. We can talk all about the different sort of epic stories about that. But the one thing that was unexpected, I'm kind of an idiot for not expecting this, but the sleep deprivation, like that was like for real. You know, I did it in 21 days, 50 states, moving all around, like bouncing around the back of an RV, basically being driven from trailhead to trailhead, try to catch a few hours of sleep in between. And it's been, I guess it's been about 3 weeks or so since I finished. And I feel like the sleep deprivation is still catching up with me. So I've done a lot of hard things over a long period of time, but not sleep. Like sleep, I slept probably 1-2 hours a night for almost a month straight. And turns out that will make you tired. So contrary to popular opinion, I am tired at times. A little bit, yeah.
But now you know how to micro nap like very well. You're very exactly. good at that.
I actually didn't realize this was possible, but when I was on Mount Whitney, which was towards the last week, it was maybe like the 42nd or 43rd of the mountains, I fell asleep while walking. My partner was out there. I didn't know that was possible. My partner was out there with me. Luckily, we were just on like kind of the trail section of that, not a huge like technical section. But he's like, has this video of me, and it looks like I'm tripping over the rocks in front of me. But actually, what was happening is I was like slowly falling asleep and then catching myself before I fell over. Falling asleep, catching myself before I fell over. So turns out if you get tired enough, you can kind of like this, give sleepwalking a new meaning, I suppose.
Sleep hiking.
Exactly.
That's fantastic.
That's amazing.
So let's talk a little about the logistics of making that happen. You know, 21 days, that's just outrageous. And so I saw from the start when you kicked it off on Denali, you went from, what was it, base camp to 11 in one push, right?
Yeah, so basically the record, the way it works is that it starts when you reach the summit of the first peak. So inevitably, or I guess logically, you go with the hardest climb first so that the ascent time is not calculated in. But of course, we wanted to move pretty quickly, as well as we got delayed actually for weeks hanging around Talkeetna for a week because of a bad storm. We basically... I actually know the bush pilot out there, this guy named Chris, and he was like, I could fly you in right now. And I was like, but it looks like there's a bad storm. He's like, yeah, it's terrible. And I was like, so you could fly us in so we sit in a storm for a week? I think I'd rather sit in Talkeetna with like some beers and a roof over my head if it's that or just not even be able to climb at all. So we waited out that storm in Talkeetna, which was good, but then we were a week behind schedule and we were trying to line up all of our logistics, like summit Denali on a specific day because we had people meeting us on the other side of the country. There's a lot of moving parts. So when we got on Denali, we needed to move quickly, even though we weren't on the clock yet. My climbing partner, a guy named Dr. John Kardowski, he joined me out there, a Colorado native. He's done some cool projects. He skied the Colorado 14ers all in a single season a couple years ago, summited Everest, like really cool guy. So anyways, he joined me for that, which was awesome to have a strong partner on that. And then he joined me later on the project as well. But anyway, so it's just me and John. And we did do a single carry up to 11 and then a single carry up to 14. So we got up to 14 camp, which I guess normally takes people maybe a week or so. We were up there in about 2.5-3 days and then waited to acclimatize for a few more days and then summited. I think it was on our sixth day we summited. But once we summited, we were on the clock. So this is where it actually got super tricky, which was we went from 14 camp. A lot of people go from 17. We went from 14 all the way to the summit. And then we wanted to get down as fast as possible because now the clock was ticking. And so strapped on the skis, skied down, packed all our stuff up at 14, skied all the way back down to the landing pad. So all of that 14 summit and back down the landing pad in about 20 hours. Then luckily we got picked up and we were in Hawaii. I was in Hawaii, not with John. He took all our gear and I was in Hawaii by basically that night. So from there, it just
outrageous.
Kicks off. Yeah.
Well, going back, okay, before we even talk about Denali, like what prompted this? What made you want to do this? I know you hold other world records, which we'll also get into, but what was the, I guess, catalyst for doing this specific challenge?
You know, a couple years ago, you know, as you alluded to, I set a world record for climbing the seven summits plus the North and South Pole. So kind of that's known as the Explorer's Grand Slam, as well as I also ended up coincidentally with that setting the Seven Summits speed record. So set two records in one with that project. And that project really was born out of this idea with my fiance and I, Jenna Bisa, who when you say logistics, I'd be remiss not to mention her because I can also tell all the epic stories logistics, but like none of this happens without her. She works on this full time as well with me. The planning, logistics, the permits, like all the madness that goes on in the background is all her master plan. She's incredible. But anyways, her and I kind of dreamed up this Beyond 7, we called it Beyond 7-2, the Seven Summits and the Two Poles project to set the world record for that, but with this kind of larger idea of using the media campaign from that to inspire young people to get outside, move their bodies, live active, healthy lives. We started a nonprofit and we really funneled a lot of the media. We ended up having something like 500 million earned media impressions. I had the most viewed Snapchat story in all of 2016 when I snapped the first person to Snapchat from the summit of Everest and stuff like that, which was a fun way to connect with young people in the outdoors, getting them excited about it, getting a window into it. But I'm honored that I often, you know, get asked to share my story in public forums, whether that's speaking at schools, speaking in corporate environments, giving a TED talk, etc. But one thing I realized is when I was speaking with students a bunch, they were like, this is an incredible story, but like I live in a city or I don't have the resources to travel abroad or stuff like that. And for me, of course, it was never about like, oh, hey, I've been to Everest, you should go on a Himalayan expedition. If that's something you want to do, like amazing. But more so people just living healthy lives, getting outside, playing in their local communities, like, you know, riding their bike to school, whatever that is. And so the 50 High Points project was really born out of this idea of saying like, you know what? Yes, I've been to, you know, some of the remotest parts of the world, North Pole, South Pole, Everest, whatever. But like, you don't have to necessarily go like across an ocean or some like crazy place to like go play outside. In fact, the United States is full of beautiful public lands in every single one of these states that are accessible and available and free, et cetera. And so the 50 High Points was really born out of that idea. So although I was setting a world record with this project to kind of get the excitement up and really kind of keep me stoked, but at the same time, we had this call to action called the Forrest Gump Effect, where we invited people, anyone, to come out and climb a peak with me, hike a mountain with me, run a mile with me on the trails, hang out at the trailhead, meet their local community members. And really, that was like the entire vision of this project was like, hey, like, how can we do something that gets people excited about being outside in the United States and then building a bunch of content and media around it for those that couldn't actually come, but to show it visually in a digital way that people got really excited about. So that was really the large inspiration behind it.
So did you get people at every mountain, at every trail?
Pretty much. There was a couple that, you know, we showed, like I was in the middle of the night in some places, but even like crazy enough. So obviously we had our schedule pretty well set and it's easier for people to like, you know, see it on the schedule. Great. You're going to be there Thursday, 7 p.m. But inevitably with 50 states, believe it or not, the schedule didn't go exactly to plan.
No.
you know, got delayed a few times, you know, stuff like that happened. But even so, like, still, like, people surprised the hell out of me. So, for example, I was in California trying to climb Whitney. You have to have a permit on a really specific – so Whitney's one of the mountains where you actually have to have a really specific permit. It's a lottery system. It's a whole thing. So no matter what, I needed to be there on July 11th. We arrive on July 11th. My dad, it was his 60th birthday, arrived to climb with me, which was cool. He's been a huge inspiration for me in the mountains. He's an Eagle Scout, you know, raised me in the outdoors and whatnot. He's 60 years old, trained for it, and – lightning strikes right at the Whitney Portal trailhead, right as we're about to start climbing. So all of a sudden, boom, trailhead's closed. You're not going to climb Mount Whitney. And so we like reshuffled this whole idea. We're like, well, if we fly to Arizona tomorrow and then like maybe then we can hit like Kansas and Nebraska and then Colorado and who knows, maybe Whitney will be reopened by then. Basically, like this is how this whole project went. Like something would go wrong and we just try to problem solve it. So that's what we did. But because of that, those dates of Arizona, Colorado, those mountains I just mentioned were, you know, off by 2 days. And so we just had to put up on Instagram like, hey, sorry to the 100 people that said they're going to meet us in Colorado. We're going to be there tomorrow and not Saturday, you know. And unfortunately, of course, we lost some people in the process of that. But still, some people just showed up. Like that night, we arrived to Kansas. It's 1 a.m., 12:30 a.m. And this guy, we get to the parking lot. Four people there in the parking lot, 1 a.m. in Kansas. We're like, holy shit, people are still here, 1 a.m. in Kansas. We roll in. They're like, yeah, what's up? Like, what's going on? And there's a couple different groups of people, but one kid in particular was incredible, a guy named Brandon. He was like, yo, I saw this morning on Instagram that you changed the time. I've been dying to meet you and come out and be a part of this event. I was sitting at work and I walked into my boss's office and said, "Hey man, I'm sorry. I've got to leave work early today and go to this." And he lived 8 hours away. So he got
in his car. That just gave me chills.
Drove 8 hours. Apparently was there from like 8 p.m. and then we got delayed a little bit even longer. So he waited there for 4 hours for us in the night. Was super stoked when we got there. And I was like, "Well, dude, like you're 8 hours away. So you're missing work tomorrow?" And he was like, "Nah, man, I'm getting in my car right now. It's 1 a.m. and I start work at 9. I'm going to drive straight to work and go straight through to work."
Oh, tomorrow. My gosh.
That's epic. I was humbled by the fact that, you know, he was so excited to come out. But, like, I mean, with that level of enthusiasm, we really did get people out of almost every single mountain participating. And as I got more and more tired and it got more challenging, just having new people, new energy around these places just really kind of kept the excitement going the entire time. It was awesome.
Now, you're going for a world record, and here you have a lot of people showing up that might not be as fit as you. Like, to what degree did that play into, like, how you hiked? Like, you're wanting to stick with these people versus wanting to go ahead and keep the pace going.
Yeah, you know, there was I feel like there was a good happy balance between that. You know, I mean, the previous record had been 41 days, so to take 20 days off the record and do it in, you know, 21 days, obviously I'm very proud of that. You know, could I have maybe done it a day faster or something? Maybe, I guess, but if I wasn't, you know, if we weren't trying to coordinate with other people's schedules and things like that. But the primary goal was really to have this be a participatory event. So I was really excited about that. And to be perfectly honest, like, there was never a time when I had to say to people like, "Hey, sorry, I need to hike faster than you." Like, people like totally understand. So for example, Mount Marcy, which is the tallest point in New York,
I guess, my backyard, from when I grew up.
So Adirondacks, obviously beautiful mountains up there. And it's actually a pretty long hike. Like, it's 15 miles round trip. We got there kind of late in the afternoon that day. Three guys joined me on the trails. And we all hiked up to the summit together. So we all hiked, you know, 8 miles together, got to the summit. It'd take us, you know, a few hours to get there. It was getting dark. And I said to them on the summit, I was like, "Hey, guys, like, I, like, have to be in Vermont in, like, 4 hours and through the middle of the night. Like, are you cool if I just trail run this thing down?" They were like, "Dude, no worries." Like, and so, like, it wasn't like, "Oh, I'm ditching you." But it was like, we climbed the mountain together, high five, pics on the summit, super fun to hang out with them. And then I, you know, tossed the headlamp on and like ran down. So I kind of was, you know, it was a balance like that. Or sometimes people came out and they're like, "Dude, I know it's a long hike and I can't like stay with you the whole time, but I really want to hike with you the first couple miles and have a chat." Or sometimes we actually didn't even realize it, but we'd get towards the summit and people are like, "Oh, we're waiting for you." Like, they had gone in a few hours ahead of time and then wanted to like be on the summit or whatever. So they kind of like self-selected. So it kind of just all worked out. We were a little worried about that, but honestly, it just worked out. And on it, the people we met were just incredible. Like, it was amazing to just hear from people. And then, you know, I'd been to a lot of these states, but, you know, there's 7 or 8 states I'd never been to. And just hearing people like, you know, we're in North Dakota and this kid messages me on my satellite little tracker and we're actually lost. And he's a local kid. And he's like, "I see you're at the wrong mountain, man. Like, come back to this trailhead, come meet us, like, whatever." And like, you know, he kind of saved the day, but it was also like, we're in the middle of nowhere in North Dakota and it's on private property. You actually have to go up a guy's driveway and there's this guy who had driven 2-3 hours to come meet us and like kind of help us out. So like, just like those stories to me is like what it was all about. It was awesome.
Yeah, I hope you're writing a book to capture all those good rat. Yeah. And that also helps people to not only like have a community around the outdoor spaces, but also just be more aware of the public lands and potentially their backyards, right? So, I mean, that guy that drove 8 hours, that's not accessible on like an afternoon, but it's more accessibility.
Exactly. And, you know, it was fun and obviously, you know, I'm from the West. I'm from the Pacific Northwest. I can literally see Mount Hood out my window here where I'm sitting. So I kind of grew up in the shadow of, you know, somewhat of a legitimate mountain with snow and glaciers, et cetera. But like, even like a place like Florida, like the highest point is 345 feet above sea level. But like, we had a crew of like local school teachers come out and we're like, "We're at the lowest high point. Like, this is awesome." I feel like just like the excitement around like kind of no matter if it was like the biggest, most challenging mountain or an easy day hike, or, you know, Florida literally is like, it's next to the parking lot. There's like a plaque basically, but like there was still excitement to come out and celebrate that as well. So I just love the diversity of that and the people that came out.
So you mentioned where you grew up, and I'm curious, what was your life like before Beyond 7-2? What was happening with Colin?
Yeah. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. I was a soccer and swimmer player. So excuse me, soccer player and swimmer growing up. So I was, you know, into sports, and then I was recruited to swim at Yale. So I ended up in your guys' neck of the woods on the East Coast college, which was of course an incredible blessing to have an education like that. But it was also a huge, you know, cultural shock for me. Like this, I was born in a hippie commune in Olympia, Washington, and grew up, you know, in Pacific Northwest. So to show up on this Ivy League campus in Connecticut was a little
different.
But in the end, loved it. You know, I just feel so fortunate to have such a great education and all of that. Then, you know, swimming was great through that time. And then, you know, the biggest, you know, kind of, you know, big turning point in my own life, kind of my own story that I speak about a lot in my TED Talk, et cetera, is, you know, just after college, I was decided to travel a bit rather than kind of taking the first job. I figured, you know, an office job was probably sitting there waiting for me at some point. But I, you know, took a surfboard and a backpack, and, you know, I had no money, but I had painted a couple houses that summer. So I had a few a few thousand bucks and was like, I'm just going to go see the world. Like, forget this like real job, real world thing quite yet. So I was putting that off as long as possible. And amazing trip around the world, mostly just surfing and bumming around, hitchhiking through New Zealand, Australia, Fiji, et cetera. It's actually where I met Jenna, you know, my now wife, 11 years ago when I was in Fiji. So I'd say it was a successful trip from that standpoint. But unfortunately, you know, halfway through that trip, I ended up getting badly burned in a fire in Thailand in the middle of nowhere, and spent, you know, several months in a Thai hospital. You know, being told I would probably never walk again normally. So I lit my entire body on fire. You know, I had to jump in the ocean nearby to extinguish the flames.
You lit your body on fire?
I was jumping, and I was foolishly, I was jumping a flaming jump rope. You know, there's smarter things that one can do, but to my
definitely
credit,
a post-college thing. Yeah,
exactly. That's like a fairly common thing, like flaming jump rope, fire dancing, et cetera. But no, I mean, it went terribly wrong for me. You know, thousands of people actually participate in, you know, this types of activities every night, you know, and don't get hurt. You know, usually if the rope trip you, it would kind of bounce off your leg, kind of like a finger through a candle flame. But in my case, unfortunately, the rope wrapped around my legs and splattered excess kerosene at my body, lit my body completely on fire. You know, and like I said, a jump in the ocean, which saved my life. You know, but not before basically all my legs had no skin on them. 25% of my body was severely burned. And it was, you know, really tough, a tough moment in my life. Obviously, the physical trauma, to say the least. I'm in the middle of nowhere. There's a cat running around my bed in the ICU, you know, and doctors are telling me I'll never walk again normally. So the emotional trauma of that was significant. But, you know, fortunately, the hero of the story is my mother, who kind of came to my bedside and said, hey, you know, I'm scared too, but, you know, let's think about what we can do when you get out of here. Like, let's set a goal. Like, your life's not over. You're 22 years old. Like, you know, like, and I was like, no, my life's over. I'll never be the same, this and that kind of thing. But she kind of just like kept hitting me with that positivity. Like, it's all about your mindset right now. Like, figure out what you want to do. Like, keep dreaming. She had always kind of like encouraged me to dream big in my life. And so whatever, I kind of closed my eyes and I was like, pictured myself crossing a finish line of a triathlon one day. And I was like, I'd never done that before, but I was just like, picture myself like able-bodied, no longer in this hospital bed, moving my body again as an athlete, and kind of picture myself racing a triathlon. So I said that to my mother, and to her amazing credit, she wasn't like, oh, you know what? I said pick a goal, like maybe pick something a little more realistic.
Just walk normally, like that's what we, yeah.
Like, she was like, all right, like that's your goal. And so, it's a much longer story, but the very short version of it is that, you know, over the next 18 months, really, you know, I flew back to Portland, still couldn't walk, was in a wheelchair. You know, she encouraged me to walk kind of really one step at a time by taking a chair from our kitchen table, placing it in front of my wheelchair, and like saying, look, your goal is to take one step today, and the next day, three steps. But with that larger goal of triathlon in my mind, 18 months after being burned in the fire, I signed up for the Chicago Triathlon. Which I, you know, was able to complete, which was, you know, a good moment for me to kind of overcome this setback in my life at a young age. But to my complete and utter surprise, I didn't just finish the race. I actually won the entire Chicago Triathlon, you know, placing first out of, you know, 4,000 other people or something like that the day, which, you know, completely changed the trajectory of my life. Yes, it allowed me to be offered a sponsorship to become, you know, a professional triathlete, which, by the way, is not like being drafted in the NBA by any means. I can eat more ramen noodles and like live off people's couches, but I can race my bike. But you know, allowed me to literally, I walked in and quit my real job the next day and, you know, moved to Australia to start racing triathlon. But the most important thing, I think, from that, when I look back, it was 10 years ago now, is that that really just shifted my mindset in general about what I'm capable of as a person and ultimately what kind of my larger mission is to inspire other people. Because what I realized in that moment is, you know what, like us as humans have incredible capacity to achieve, to do incredible things. That we have reservoirs of untapped potential inside of us. And there's really nothing standing in our way other than our own mindset, our own beliefs, and if we can do them. And my mother somehow convinced me and taught me one of my life's greatest lessons, that even in my hardest, hardest, darkest moments, that if I focused on something positive, if I had purpose, if I really was dedicated, that I could achieve something. And I achieved it not just by finishing the race, but by winning. And so much of my mission, so much of my, you know, I became a professional triathlete, raced all over the world, you know, 25 countries, 6 continents with the U.S. national team, did this Explorers Grand Slam world record, did this 50 high points world record. And really through all of that, it's been either just internally kind of teaching myself, but more so now that I have a bit of a public platform, is inspiring others to do the same. And it's not, you know, I think all of us, you know, the three of us obviously love the outdoors, but, you know, even if you're not an outdoor enthusiast, it's like, you know, entrepreneurship, love, business, art, creativity, like whatever that is inside of you, like find your thing and like chase it with all of your heart. Because you know what, like when you do that, we can just achieve so many wonderful things. And the world, I think, is just an amazing place when people are engaged and focused and with things like that.
I'm going to let that segment just sit and resonate a little bit. So for you listening, please just rewind about 3 or 4 minutes and hit play again.
Let it run.
Find what you love and chase it with all your heart and channel the positivity to keep pushing toward new goals.
Okay. That's great.
Perfect.
I guess we can just end now.
So let's, I want to talk about one thing. You just kind of breezed over it, talking about your career as a triathlete, and then you did the Explorers Grand Slam. And that right there is like, what was the gap between being a triathlete and you being like, I could climb the 7 summits, like become a mountaineer?
Yeah, so it's a very important inflection point in my life. So 2014, I always loved the mountains, like I mentioned, you know, growing up here in Portland, Oregon. But I was never any sort of like professional climber. In fact, I wasn't even like really that. I liked hiking, and my family didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, so it was kind of like the easiest, cheapest thing to do was to like drive out to like a lake or a trailhead and like go for a hike or a bike ride like that. But it wasn't like I was some like super technically proficient mountaineer. But I always loved it, and always, you know, kind of over time had just like learned some of the, you know, basic cramponing and basic, you know, just every year as a kid, teenager, whatever, just learned a little bit more. And it just, it stuck as a passion of mine. And in 2014, so during my professional triathlon career, Jenna was on the road with me more or less full time, managing sponsors, logistics, and also just kind of just supporting what I was doing. It was amazing to have her as we were traveling and living all over the world. And we would try when we ended up, I would race in these kind of, you know, far off places, and we'd always go, oh, in between the off season or when we have a little break in training, like let's go do a little adventure that was fun, that would kind of keep my body fit, but give me a little bit of break from the grind of the swimming, biking, and running. So we started actually climbing mountains in some of these places. So I raced in Africa and we climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I raced in Japan, we climbed Mount Fuji. And then in the fall of 2014, I'd been doing some racing in South America, and I had always wanted to climb some of Ecuador's volcanoes. And so we did a trip to climb Cotopaxi, Cayambe, and Chimborazo. And on the summit of Cayambe, I pulled out a diamond ring out of my pocket and asked her to marry me. Which fortunately she said yes. I don't know.
Again, take notes, people. Rewind.
90,000 feet, and she just wanted to make sure she got down safely. So if she said no, wouldn't, you know, been a good descent. No, but you know, in that moment, of course, we're starting to think about like, you know, what do we want to do next with our life? And it was an interesting moment because I had sponsorship for at least a couple more years, and really, you know, would assume that we could renew those. Like my racing was going well. I had racing 6 years. I had, you know, just had won a big professional race a month before that and a half Ironman. So there was a pathway for me to keep racing. I was 29 years old. Professional triathletes often race well into their mid to late 30s, very successfully. But it was kind of a moment where we asked ourselves, like, what are our priorities? Like, what do we super care about? What do we want the next 5-10 years of our life to look like? And we kind of, you know, we're having these conversations all the while in the mountains. And, you know, kind of two things came top of mind to us. One is, I still wanted to be an athlete. Like, I still was very much like, hey, like, I've worked super hard to get my body to where it is. But I also felt a little bit limited by triathlon specifically. I love it. I would never, you know, I love the entire experience of it. But I was just kind of ready for the next thing. There's an Emerson quote that I am really fond of that says, unless you do something beyond what you've already mastered, you will never grow. And I don't try to pretend as if I had fully mastered triathlon, but I was a professional. I was highly ranked in the world. I had sponsorship, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I was like, what's the next thing? Like, what's that next, like, big, crazy, audacious goal that feels like wildly out of reach? So we kind of started dreaming and riffing on that. And then the other thing was, we were like, and you know what, the next thing we do, we want to do something that has a little bit larger of a scope and impact than just our own personal success or failure on the race course. Like, it's great to race triathlon, but it's not super visible. You know, there wasn't a lot we could do in the community and things like that. And Jenna and I both are super passionate about, you know, inspiring young people, certainly around health and wellness. My dad's an organic farmer, kind of food, health, wellness. This, you know, activity has been a big part of, you know, my childhood and whatnot. And so we said, what if we do some crazy big project and kind of create like a media story around it, start a nonprofit, and can really like utilize A, my passion for doing what I'm doing, but to really inspire others to the same thing, learn that same lesson that I had in the Thai hospital, but without having to burn themselves in a fire, or, you know, understand the
importance. That's a good checkpoint to skip.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely don't need to do that to learn the lesson that, you know, as humans, we have amazing capacity inside of us. So really it was kind of this brainstorming phase. And I think you guys being, you know, entrepreneurs yourselves, as well as, you know, I know interviewing entrepreneurs and whatnot, it really was a foray into entrepreneurship, although it was, you know, it started off as really much a nonprofit effort. It was, you know, actually the room that I'm sitting in right now, it was, you know, we have this photo and it's Jenna and I, and we have this whiteboard and it's us. We'd written out the Explorer's Grand Slam and there's like a map, and we had like taken like pieces of yarn and like, you know, been like, you know, the seven summits, like Everest, Denali, you know, Kilimanjaro, North Pole, South Pole, whatever. And then we're like kind of looking at each other and being like, so that's a cool idea on a whiteboard. We don't have the $500,000 in sponsorship we need to do it. We know nothing about marketing. We know nothing about PR. I have like 100 Instagram or Twitter followers. Like, we didn't have any of the things that you would need to do a global media campaign and this really expensive expedition and start a nonprofit and all of this. But we had the vision for it. And in the same vein, I think, you know, definitely off the same lesson of learning of what I had learned, you know, with this burn accident and recovering literally one step at a time, you know, we looked at each other and we're like, okay, like, we don't have $500,000 right now. We need that. Yes. But like, we need to learn the first steps first. So we literally sit in front of our laptops. I remember literally Googling, Google, what's the difference between marketing and PR? I mean, like, we need nothing, right? But flash forward, I mean, there's a lot of stories in between, but flash forward 2.5 years and we set this, you know, we set this world record. Obviously something happened in those 2 years. So that first Google led to a meeting with a friend of ours that led to 5 coffees with other people that led to 100 brands saying no, 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 no. But the 101st happened to be Nike, which said, yeah, I mean, it all built on itself. Tons of failures, tons of setbacks in raising that money, whatever. But in the end, we raised the money. We did the project. We started a nonprofit. We had 500 million earned media impressions, and we realized that vision that was written on that whiteboard. But if any time during the way we had listened to that voice in our head that so easily pops up that goes, you can't, you don't have the money, you don't have the time, you're not a good enough mountaineer. Like, what do you know about pulling a sled to the North Pole? Like, you know, there's all of the can'ts along the way. You know, the governmental process of registering a 501c3 is like not simple either. And you need a lawyer. And you need like all of those things, right? Like, there's so many hurdles along the way, but we just literally kept plugging away day by day by day by day. And I, again, like, you know, like to tell people, it's like, it's not because Jenna and I are necessarily the smartest or the luckiest or the this. It's that, like, we just kept showing up. We literally kept waking up every single day and like trying something. And way more often than not, it failed. But enough of the things went right that we pulled it off. And here we are now with, you know, continuing to build.
So are you still knocking on brands' doors and getting 100 no's, or are you getting 50 no's? And is it a little easier now that you have this under your belt?
Yeah, you know, obviously we've been fortunate to have some really great partners along the way, and, you know, continue to have great brand relationships. And those brands have, you know, changed and evolved of who they are and what, you know, just different brands that we work with now. It's still challenging. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's just like, even though with, you know, now with three world records and, you know, ton of press and having been on, you know, TV, blah, 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 whatever, that it's just like overnight, like just like, yep, like tons of like brand money is coming in. You still have to have creative vision. You also have to figure out what you want to do next and where you want to take that. Yes. I mean, the simple answer is, of course, it has gotten easier. I can get more meetings than I could get previously or whatnot. But the whole brand partnership game, which is, you know, obviously a big part of what fuels the outdoor industry and pro athletes and stuff in that space, is really about finding the right match. Because, you know, as glamorous as it might be, like, oh, I'm sponsored by the X company or Y company, it's so awesome, whatever. Like, it really has to be a great pairing. So, you know, for example, you know, a brand that I started working with this year that I absolutely love, and I might be the best brand partnership I've ever had, is a company called Standard Process, which is the largest whole food supplement company in the country. You know, deeply involved in chiropractor, acupuncture, whole food supplements and whatnot. And their just mission is so aligned with my mission. They've been around 100 years. They're family owned. You know, like I said, my dad's an organic farmer. And so like, I really have those same core values around that. And they're all trying to spread the word about nutrition, health, wellness, the outdoors, et cetera. And so when I planned this project, the 50 High Points, you know, they couldn't have been more enthusiastic, of course, financially supportive, but also just such strong brand align. It wasn't like, hey, I want to do this, but can we fit it into your like marketing profile of like this? It was like every time it was like we were just speaking the same language, and all the stuff I want to do, they want to do, they were excited about and whatnot. And so finding, for me, it's more than having it be easier to find creative partners. It's about finding like the right and amazing people to work with. And I should mention, you mentioned logistics, so I got to throw this out there as a shout out to them, which is we spent a lot of time in a Cruise America RV, which was a partner on this project, 10,000 miles on that. But Standard Process also did let us use what they call the company time machine. But it was the company private jet to take to a few of these far off segments on the 50 HP, which definitely cut a few days off of our time. So, you know, something like that, it was like they didn't have to do that. That was not like part of like the deal or whatever. They were just like, this is awesome and you're gonna do this record. And like, they looked, the CEO Charlie looked at the map and was like, dude, take the plane to a couple of these spots. So I mean, that's just kind of a fun, crazy life experience that was amazing. But it just goes to show a company that I just super, super, super believe in, and being able to work with them. And now, you know, I'm in their nutrition lab with some of the top doctors and innovators in food science, working on my next project to totally understand my physiology and doing all this blood work and understanding exactly what foods are fueling me the right way and whatever. And the idea with that is to publish a white paper after the end of my next project on actually cracking the, you know, human physiology and innovation. So it's cool to finally get to a level with brands that I can work with them, not just on like, cool, wear my sunglasses and take a picture and put it up on your Instagram. I'm not hating on that. I mean, that's still cool, but it's cool to go a couple levels deeper to like innovation, science, research, that kind of stuff. At least for me, that's what totally lights me up at this point. And it's really fun.
For sure.
That's like a true partnership at that point too. You're like you know, equal parts. And I think the key thing there is the vision board that you had. I'm a big fan of whiteboards. Jonathan knows this. There's actually one that we have like all these notes on in front of us too. And I see yours there in the corner. But so I think that's so key, because a lot of times people will reach out to brands like, hey, we're doing this thing. Do you want to tell a story about it or what? And it's more about like, okay, this is why we're doing this thing. This is the, I guess, the story that we feel passionate about, rather than, like you said, fitting into that small box.
Totally, totally. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, you hit the nail on the head there with the why, which is, you know, I guess there could be in the world of social media, there's some simple quid pro quos. I have X amount of followers. You want this amount of reach. I want a photo of my thing on this. Like, that's as simple as it comes. And again, nothing wrong with that. I do that from time to time as well. But really going a level deeper, I get emails from people frequently kind of on the business side of things. They're like, wow, I've heard your story. I've seen you put together these projects that were obviously, you know, just the overhead costs of them were, you know, going to North Pole, South Pole, logistics in Antarctica, like that stuff's very expensive. And I'm not, you know, some trust fund kid that can just write that check. you know, figuring that out has, of course, taken some strategic business acumen. But I mean, you really hit the nail on the head, which is like, what's the story you want to tell? Like, what's the value? Like, what is like really like the deeper essence of that? Because that's what's really going to you find the right partnerships. Just being like, I'm doing this, cool, right? Like, you should like want to be like, everyone thinks the thing they're doing is cool. And like, I'm not knocking people for being stoked about what they're doing. But if the business part of it's important, and by the way, like just doing this stuff for fun and like having a fun with it and not making business part of it, I'm all about that too.
That's great too, yeah.
Like if you have some huge vision that requires you want sponsors and all this sort of stuff, I think people do commonly make the mistake of like printing up a one pager. It's like, yo, I'm doing this. It's cool, right? Like such and such brand should like totally give me all this free stuff. And you're kind of like, well, like what are you providing? What's the story? What's the deeper why? What's the purpose? All this sort of stuff. So people ask me that question a lot, and I love, you know, kind of mentoring a bit and giving some advice around that. But it is, I'm still learning. Like it says, it's of an ever evolving, progression of just finding the right people to work with. And yeah.
I think it's about being willing to have conversation after conversation after conversation, like going up against the 50 or the 100 or the 1,000, you know, that you talked about. Like a few years back, I had a big goal to go do Aconcagua and then go up the Pan American to Denali and volunteer for a week in every country along the way. And it was going to be this like big 4 to 6 month expedition. And it was right after college. And I was this no name person with no presence, with like, I had never climbed anything over 14,000 feet. And like, went sleeping in my car around Boulder Canyon, Colorado, knocking on doors, passing out like brand, like flyers with the project, like trying to get you know, the right conversation, the right partner. And it was like the first one was like Justin's Nut Butter. And I was like, sweet, I'll eat nothing but nut butter for 5 months. but you're right. And then after that, doors start to fall. But even still, it's like, it's not easy. You do one project and.
Totally. And yeah. I think that, I mean, the truth of the matter is that if I just heard about that project, like that's like, I love that project. And like, I would love to hear more about it. Like, that's super cool. But like the thing that you almost glossed over is you were like, but then I actually took this idea and then went and knocked on all the doors and like heard people say no. And was like willing to be like, yo, Justin, that's dope. Like whatever. Like you met the amount of people. Again, this is not to knock on people, but hopefully to inspire people that like are sitting in that proverbial chair like I was with my legs burnt and have that one chair in front of him. It's just too hard to get up and take that first step because it's just too hard. It's too painful. It's too embarrassing when someone says no. Like all of those fears, like we're all human, right? Like we have these doubts and fears. It's just part of the human condition in our mind, but overcoming them to step into that discomfort of being like, you know what? I'm passionate enough about this crazy Aconcagua to Denali like long mission that like I'm just gonna go start talking to people about it. And I'm gonna start like asking my friend of a friend of a friend who like might know somebody if they'll like take a meeting with me. And like that might not go nowhere, but like I'm willing to like drive across town or fly across the country or pick up the phone or whatever that is, and figure it out. I mean, even you guys, just the story you told me about just like getting people on your podcast and whatnot, it's like you'll email people, but you're not like, oh, the assistant said no, he doesn't have time. Like you're like, assistant said no, like let's just walk up to that guy. He's standing right over there.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that's what it, I mean, those are the types of people that I love being around. Cause that's like really in the end of the day, like it's the effort, it's the hustle, and doesn't always pay off in a linear way, but you know, looking back, you can see it all pay off. And so I'm all about that for sure.
So thinking about like standard processes helping you understand your nutrition and trying to figure out like the perfect balance with all of that, but like, what does it take to train to be able to do the 50 highest peaks here, but also then the 7 summits and the 2 poles? Like, what does that training regimen look like for you?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You know, I think I kind of have two answers to that question. One is, you know, the specificity over, say, the 6 month or a year leading up to a big project obviously goes into it. So, example, when I was training for the 7 summits, you know, I did another expedition in an 8,000 meter peak in the Himalayas, Manaslu. You know, I was doing a lot of, honestly, I was training, I was still racing as a professional triathlete that entire year because that was my income. So I was swimming, biking, running, doing a bunch of cardio, strength, you know, working on more technical proficiency in the mountains, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, 50 high points was obviously going to be a lot of trail running and stuff like that. Denali's, you know, sled pulling up, you know, heavy loads uphill, stuff like that. So it was simulating that, trail running, etc. So that all like goes into it. And as I sort of dream up these projects, obviously there's kind of like that, do I have this skill? What's the skill acquisition that I need? But one of the things I like to tell people is like a lot of the stuff that I do, yes, like it's great to be outside and like be in the mountains. I think that there's no better training, but like so much of it can be done also indoors. Like, you know, actually yesterday I was like, my knees felt a little bit like kind of just been doing a lot of running. The 50 high beams kind of pounded my knees a lot just because so much downhill running.
Yeah.
So I was like, I was at my local gym at LA Fitness 2 blocks from my house. I'm doing a spin class yesterday. Like, you know, like I'm a professional athlete and like I know I have this like really regimented thing, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, sometimes it's like just something as simple as that. It's like, yep, like I need to get some cardio in, like crank the music up, like have the teacher tell me what to do and do that. I mean, it's like I'm not like above like doing stuff like that as well. But obviously there's a lot of more specificity that in general goes into my training. But the second answer to that question is that this has been in a lot of ways a progression for me, a lifelong progression for me, which back to being a 5-year-old kid who jumped in a pool, who then, you know, swam every day for 15 years, that then became a professional triathlete. And that, and I don't say that to discourage people like, oh God, if you weren't a lifelong athlete, then you can't do this now. But for me personally, my personal journey has been really a lifelong of doing aerobic sports, of skill acquisition, of the mental training that's required to like stare at a black line on the bottom of a swimming pool. By the way, we're most boring sport ever to me. you know, all of the above has kind of, you know, led to my, at least my personal journey to get to where I am for sure.
So you've been moving your entire life. Like, is it hard for you to sit still? Do you ever give, like, is that a mental struggle? It is for me sometimes to, like, give myself permission to just, like, stop and to not overdo it.
No, it's, I mean, I've overtrained myself a couple of times pretty severely. So I've learned that lesson the hard way through my triathlon career, like literally, you know, testosterone level, you know, 24-year-old guy with testosterone level of like a 90-year-old man, because I've just like pushed it too hard. So finding those edges, again, lessons hard learned and required me to take some time off and stuff like that, but certainly learned more about my body through some of those mistakes. But, you know, I have learned as I've gotten a little bit older, I'm 33 now, that I actually really appreciate some of the quieter moments. Like I like some of the slower, quieter moments in my life. About 7-8 years ago, I got introduced to Vipassana meditation. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but there's these 10-day meditation retreats that are completely silent, no reading, no writing, no eye contact, basically meditating in isolation alone, obviously sitting still, for 10 days at a time. And I went to my first one in 2011, and it was just a life-changing experience for me. And now that's become kind of a yearly ritual of, you know, taking those 10 days every year to literally slow down as much as possible. Wow. You know, turn off the phone. Like I said, no reading, no writing, no icon. I mean, you're really sitting in your own thoughts, completely still. And, you know, the learnings that I've come and insight that's come from me from that has been, you know, tremendously valuable in just kind of my own personal life, as well as sort of, you know, mental fortitude and stuff like that. So, you know, people definitely say that to me like, oh, you're always moving, you're always running around, all this crazy stuff, but it's a balance. And even in, you know, to go back to your training question, you know, I train super hard. Obviously, I push my body really hard. I'm training for a big project now, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's easy to forget that we actually get stronger when we are resting, right? Like when we're recovering, that's actually when the muscles are getting stronger. And so it's life in general is that way, which is as much as I appreciate the hustle, the grind, the entrepreneurship, all this sort of stuff, I do think that people sometimes think like I nap in the middle of the day. I mean, I'm hustling, I'm grinding, I'm sending emails, I'm making phone calls, I'm working out hard, but like then I'll be like, yo, like I'm going to like meditate, or I'm going to nap for an hour. I'm going to like, you know, like having that balance actually gives me a sustainable amount of energy over a longer duration of time than just like a crazy outburst of like 1 or 2 or 3 weeks. And I think that that's, to me, in terms of achieving long-term goals, at least, you know, for me anyways, I think it's super important. Because if you use the example of, you know, it's New Year's Eve and everyone signs up for a gym membership and shows up to like the local gym on like January 1st, they're like, I'm going to lose 20 pounds this year, whatever. And then they go to the gym every day for 10 days. And then the 11th day, they're like, you know what? Like, this sucks. I can't do this every single day. What would have been way better is to say like, you know what? Like, I don't go to the gym ever. You know what I'm going to do is like go to the gym twice a week for the next like 8 weeks. And then maybe after 8 weeks, you're like, maybe I'll go add the third day in there or something like that. So I'm a big believer in incremental gains over time being the difference, or having that sort of, you know, lifestyle balance, you know, just as healthy and stuff as I am, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I have my moments, or like, I party, I have fun. I don't follow like super strict diet always, you know, like I stay out late, you know, stuff like that too. It's like, I also live a full life, in balance and harmony that I think adds, you know, richness to it all.
I think the New Year's thing, that would actually help me too. So then there's not as many people in the gym for like 10 days. It's like, exactly. Like, let's reduce that a little bit.
Yeah. And everybody space it out.
Yeah.
So regarding the lifestyle balance, you know, that's something that we try and talk to everybody about is like how you are balancing the business and the athletic pursuits and all the adventure and your relationship with, you know, with both your wife and the rest of your family or your friends. Like, what do you do to kind of, you know, sometimes balance is this thing that just nobody seems to be able to figure out and be able to achieve. And sometimes it's not balance in the moment, but it's balance over time. Like, you give one thing a lot of effort now, and then it comes back to something else later. Like, what's your strategy for that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I have certainly spent a lot of time thinking about. You know, I just like other things in my life, I succeed or fail at different, varying degrees at different times. But one of the things that I would say anyways, is sort of the myth of balance a little bit, is that when we think of balance, at least even where my mind originally goes, like, okay, let's divide our life into like three categories. Like, there's work, there's personal life, and there's like personal life, family, and then personal life, personal hobbies, friends, or something like that. You think of balance, you're like, okay, that would necessarily be like a third, a third, a third. And really, like, I don't, in my mind anyways, like, a successful balance doesn't actually look like in every given day there is exact balance given to everything. And I think you said it a little bit more there. It's kind of like, what does it look like over the longer duration of life? And so, you know, one example that's just specific to my life is that Jenna and I, we also work together full time. Right. So, you know, we've dreamed all this up together. We've created it all together. It's as much her success as it has been my success. And we also have a romantic relationship in the context of that. And we also have friends that aren't our business colleagues, and we also have family and all that sort of stuff. And so we've, you know, literally had to develop, and we were worse at this years ago. We've gotten better at it, of actually saying like, okay, like, it's not work time right now. Cause like, we're always thinking about these creative ideas. And for me, like, this idea of work, like, I just love what I do and we love what we do. So it's interesting. So it's like, doesn't quite like if I'm talking about some big project or this, or some like, you know, follow up on some sponsorship or something like that, like, I don't necessarily feel like, oh God, I'm working right now. But she has like helped me be like, you know what? Like, it's like Saturday at 3 p.m. and you're hanging out with like your 9-year-old like nephew. Like, maybe just like throw the ball around and hang out and like not be thinking about that right now. So really kind of being thoughtful and tactical about when to switch that on and off. And I think that it's the blessing and the curse of an entrepreneur, right? Which is, it's great to be self-employed. It's great to run your own thing. I think it's really exciting to have that, but you also can easily fall into the trap of like only doing that one thing all of the time. And then the other thing that, you know, Jen and I have both realized, at least with what I do with these, say, these big projects and things like that, is that they often have a beginning, middle, and end to them, which is, you know, we plan a big project. Maybe we start it a year in advance. We start kind of thinking about it and whatever. And then we know that like the month ahead of time, the actual doing of the thing, and maybe the month after, is going to be like all hands on deck, like crazy intense time. And we don't try to balance our life during that time, like, because we also love being fully immersed in a singular task. Like, when we were doing the 50 high points, we weren't also like in 21 days and Jenna's driving this RV 10,000 miles and like all these crazy things that went on. She wasn't like, you know what, like, I should be like chit chatting with my mom on a daily basis during this, and I should also be like this. It's like we have built our relationships around us to, for people to understand the expectations of like, hey, like, there are times when we're like blinders on, like wildly focused on something like that. And it's not because we don't love you, and it's not because we're not like engaged in what you're doing, but there is a time and a place. And if we were doing that all of the time, I think people would be like, you know, these guys aren't good friends, or they're not good, you know, siblings or whatnot. But they understand, like, they see the effort that goes into that. So when it's that hyper intense moment for us, we can be super focused, and we feel like we have the permission to do that with the band, with still within the confines of balance in our life. So, like I said, that's kind of a little bit of our story, and it's still something that's a, you know, a work in progress. And I think not tomorrow, but at some point, next few years, kids is probably on the horizon for us. And so figuring out, a new recalibration of that balance, I can only imagine what that looks like. But I think balance is both important, but also commonly misunderstood to take away, because I think true high performance, I've been fortunate to be around Olympic athletes and Fortune 100 CEOs and traditionally thought of high performers, and most of those people got there by, at least at certain points of their life, being very, very, very focused on a singular thing and not having balance. And the ones that I think have cultivated amazing lives have also figured out how to implement balance at certain ones. And certain, there's certainly people that I've seen high perform that are really great at their one thing, but the rest of their life is in shambles on their outside of that. And that's certainly not, I don't personally aspire to that, I guess. So,
It seems like you're crafting the right lifestyle. You're going after what feels authentic and right for you. But I totally get what you're talking about.
Yeah. Like I said, it's a work in progress. I don't have it all figured out, man. But those are some of my thoughts on it anyways.
Do you have like a routine, whether daily, weekly, or like incrementally? Like I've been, as of recently, trying to do this like morning routine and like look at these 90-day challenges and different like four core aspects of my life. And that's been helping me get to different goals. Like, do you have a strategy for your days or your weeks or short-term points of the year?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit hard for me because the cycle of my year and month and week are, I can't remember the last time it was like week one was the same as week two, certainly not the same as week 10. Just with, I travel a ton, I'm doing different things and whatnot. But there's a couple little, like for me, little tricks that work for me anyways. Since I literally sleep in different hotel rooms, tents, et cetera, all over the place, I always sleep with an eye mask on and earplugs, the same eye mask and earplugs, no matter where I am. And that just gives me a little bit of regularity in my sleep, even though the location itself is different. It's a little like weird little like routine thing that I have.
I like it.
That works. In the mountains too?
Yeah, mountains too, everywhere. Yep. Yeah, no matter where I am, people that have spent a long time, as we are known for, is a blue eye mask. Like it's always there. That's one. And the other thing that I've, at least for myself, is a lot of people call it morning routine or whatnot. I don't necessarily do the exact same thing every morning when I wake up. Although when I do get into more of that, I do find a healthy routine, whether that's through meditation and whatnot. But I do realize that there is a moment in time in any given day that I have where I feel like I really have the full control over the day. And that is like the morning hours. That's like before checking my phone, before like all the emails come in or the demands on my calendar or whatever that might be. It's like, if I get up at 7, like I feel like I've got a couple hours, whether that's usually that's for me, it's like it's working out or it's moving my body or it's meditating or it's something like that. But I try to have that, kind of keep that morning time to myself, no matter where I am. And so it's not a full answer to like, I do this exact thing because my life is just like changing constantly. But I try to insert a few moments of constant control, I guess, in a rather kind of, all over the place lifestyle at times.
Yeah, I like it. Those are good tips. I like it a lot.
So I know you said you're not going to announce the project, but what kind of teaser can you give us of whatever you're working towards?
It's probably badass. So, spoiler.
Yeah. So, I will be announcing, it won't be too long until I announce what it is. But I will say this, it's my most ambitious project yet. It's the most challenging thing that I will have ever undertaken in my life. And the teaser that I will give, which will be very apparent, is on Thursday. So it's Monday right now. I don't know when this is going to be actually released, but, 3 days from now, I leave for an expedition in Greenland, to cross the country of Greenland, from east to west, 400 miles, across the ice cap there. And that project itself is a bit of training and prep for what I will be putting myself into on my next project. So I'll leave it at that. I'm excited to keep pushing myself this year and hopefully having the cascading effect into the work that I do in the community and impact and my nonprofit and all those things that are a result of that. But yeah, a lot of hard work and excitement has gone into what will unfold over the rest of this year.
It just doesn't stop.
As it shouldn't.
No one can see me, but I basically covered my face when he was talking about Greenland. Like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
No, that's great, man. I'm super excited for you. So you said you're leaving in just a few days?
Yeah, so I'll always through my expeditions, I love to keep everyone in the loop as much as I can with setting images through my satellite device. Like I said, I Snapchat from the summit of Everest, so I'm known to keep up on the social channels and stuff like that. So if you're tuning in, check out at Colin O'Brady on my Instagram. We'll definitely be coming at you with some photos live every single day from Greenland. And like I said, that's all leading up to a larger announcement in the late summer, early fall, as to what the next phase will unfold.
Now, is this the kind of thing where I can meet you at the trailhead?
he's really
I don't know. It sounds like you're down to do some long, crazy things. So perhaps you might be the perfect person to meet me at the trailhead this time.
Perfect. I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Cool. So we've got one last question that we ask everybody we have on the Stokecast. Emily, what is that?
Always putting me on the spot. Is what does Stoke mean to you?
What does Stoke mean to me? I love that. To me, it just means excitement, passion, vibrancy. And I'll actually say it also means flow. I'm really fascinated with the concept of flow, these moments when we find ourselves so deeply immersed in what it is that we're doing, that you're just caught in a present moment. Whatever that's could be a meditation, just deeply, deeply in the present moment. But I think in the outdoor community, I describe that stoke of when you're ripping down the face of a beautiful wave, or you're skiing shoulder deep powder, or whatever. Just that smile that's on your face, like to me, that is the stoke. And in that moment, like I've never been surfing a wave and thought to myself, like, I wonder what emails are in my inbox. You're like, I should call that person, whatever. You're just in it. You're just in that moment. I can recognize it on my own face, but I can certainly recognize it more importantly on the faces of others when you look back over your shoulder in a wave or in that ski moment or in any other times of life, a mother picking up their child and just smiling, just like that happiness in a moment that's fully caught and present. And to me, that's the deepest and most important essence of life.
Every Amazing. Time, every I know.
You're,
time.
You're always blown away. Emily just like every time she takes a answers. Very deep breath and she just like, and she just falls in love with every answer. Just, I mean, they're all
let
always
me live.
Fantastic.
Let
I will
me
let
live.
You live. Awesome, man. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Some really cool projects, dude. So from Beyond 7 to, which was your world record setting Explorers Grand Slam, which is now your nonprofit, where yep. you are inspiring kids to live healthy outdoor lifestyles.
Yep.
And then HP 50.
50 HP.
Or 50 HP. Not sorry about that. 50 HP. Yep. I'm just yep. getting all confused.
He's getting flustered by
right?
the stoke.
Getting
answer.
Flustered by the stoke. and something new coming soon.
Stay tuned on that for sure.
We'll be following along.
Cool.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure being here.
Oh, my goodness. Colin O'Brady. What a rad guy. And that answer for the what does Stoke mean to you. That was, like, beautiful.
I know, right? That, like, I want to just put that on a poster and hang it in, like, our office wall or something. Like, that's – I mean, I know we're on the topic of posters, and we're going to get to that. But, like, that's deserving of printing.
So good. I just, I really do admire his energy and he just seems to have so much drive, but I think there's a lot that we can take away from him. I loved how he went from the vision board to, a fully sponsored expedition and that process and how he made it happen with his wife, Jenna. It was all really inspiring. And I remember
being in the room with you, Jonathan, and just being like, oh my gosh, this guy is just energizing us.
I know. You're just like nudging me along the whole time. You're like, are you listening? Are you listening? Of course I'm listening. It was fantastic. And yeah, I mean, it really does. It takes the vision, it takes the hustle, and it so much takes the people around you that are supporting you. Like that is such a huge component of, you know, you see one person achieving a record or standing on a mountain or whatever, but it takes so much to get them there, the people behind the scenes.
Right. Yeah. And like all the base work that he put into living this lifestyle where people just see him succeeding now, but he's like, no, I've been an athlete my whole life. I came back from this whole horrible accident, like all this stuff. And so I think that actually your wife, I think, posted something today where it's like someone on a winner, like a runner's block, you know, when you win a race, but then below the ground, what you can't see is all their like hustle and, you know, sad time, bad times and perseverance and all this stuff. And I thought that was really, actually I thought of Colin when I saw that image. It's like a cartoon.
For sure. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting with like Colin started, you know, his athletic career, well, not started, but I mean, before all of these records, he was a world champion triathlete, as we just heard. And then he started getting into mountaineering, and like, you know, my experience is kind of reverse. Like I've been into mountaineering for a while, and I just did my first triathlon this summer, which I've told you a little about how ridiculous that went, right?
Yeah. It's pretty embarrassing. Lessons learned for you though, right?
Totally. I mean, you know, typical triathletes, they show up, they're standing at the race line, they've got their like wetsuits or their singlets or whatever. And I show up, and not only had I lost my goggles that morning and like grabbed a dive mask out of my snorkel kit, but I'm just like standing there with my dive mask on and like my Patagonia board shorts and like look so 100% out of my element. And I was, and I learned a lot through that race.
We always need to do, I think from a past episode we learned, we always should be pushing ourselves in areas that we're not very good at so that we can be humbled.
That's right.
And learn something new.
100%. All right, cool. So let's talk, we'll transition. Obviously, Colin is the current speed record holder for the Seven Summits. And I mentioned we have these Seven Summits posters, which again, it was basically my friend Ethan's girlfriend Mary, who was wanting to like give Ethan a nice present, and she sent me something like a poster she had found of Kilimanjaro on Etsy, and was like, "Hey, what do you think of this? You know, I might be able to get this person I know to make others like that." And I was like, It's kind of not that great. Let me see what I can do. So I had seen these incredible national park posters a couple years back when I was actually looking for this same thing, and I knew that they didn't have the Seven Summits, but the national park posters were incredible. And so I had bookmarked the site, and what it was Anderson Design Group store. And this isn't like any sort of an ad whatsoever. You know, it's just I'm a huge fan of their designs. So Anderson Design, I reached out and was just like, "Hey, look, this is the situation. I love your national park series. I'm a climber. I've been on these three mountains. I'm someday gonna get to the other four, and we're trying to get these designed and printed for a friend, and wondering, you know, there's probably a market of people out there like me who have done or who are after the Seven Summits that would really dig this series." And they were so on board, and you know, picked my brain a little bit about like the inspirations for the landscapes and the animals or the climbing or the mountainscapes and whatever. And then their designers just went at it, and they created this amazing, just beautiful poster series of, you know, of Aconcagua down in South America, of Denali up in Alaska, of Karstens Pyramid, which is the tallest mountain in Australasia, and obviously Kilimanjaro in Africa, and then Everest out in Asia, and Vincent Massif in Antarctica, and Elbrus in Europe, and this series is beautiful. And we have a set of 11 by 14 printed posters to give away to one lucky listener.
Oh my gosh.
How's that going to work?
Oh my gosh. Well, they have to, our listeners have to go to the site, the Colin O'Brady episode. So it's stokecast.com. I'm sorry. Oh my God.
Always getting the URL wrong.
Okay, you do the URL and then I'll do the rest.
It's exploreinspired.com/Colin-O'Brady. Or you can just go to exploreinspired.com/stokecast and you'll see all the past show episodes there and just click on Collins.
Okay, back to the regular programming. So then what you're going to do is you're going to tell us in the comment section in the Colin O'Brady episode, what was the main takeaway that you took from his episode? What kind of inspiration did he give you? What kind of tidbit were you laughing at? Whatever it was, the biggest takeaway that you have. And Jonathan and I are going to choose the best one and give that person those amazing posters, which I have seen them in person, a larger scale version of them in Mary and Ethan's house, and they are dope. So you're going to want them in your house if you're aspiring or even just love the national parks look that Jonathan is talking about. It's super beautiful and great artwork for your gear room or just anywhere, really.
Yeah, if you like to travel or climb, I mean, even if you're not a climber and you're just trying to like visit all seven continents, or you just like beautiful art, I mean, they're great. So yeah, just go to Colin's episode or the show notes page and comment what you learned, what you're inspired by from this episode, or what you're inspired to do. And again, we'll read through your comments and we'll pick our very favorite one, and then we'll share that on a future episode, and you will get these posters.
Wow, that is pretty freaking cool, man. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. I can't wait to hear what people say.
Responses.
Totally.
I'm stoked. All right. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing, definitely also subscribe and review and rate us. We'd love that feedback, and just let us know how you're feeling about the podcast. But we love you all, and we're so happy that we're going to be able to continue for this season too.
Yeah, I know. We're kind of like, you and I have been thinking of this as season one and season two, because like when we went at creating this, we were just like, all right, let's just do this batch of 12 episodes. We'll pre-record them and then we'll release them every week through the summer and see what happens. And so that's, I guess, like our mental partitioning. But to anybody out there, I mean, there's no, it's just continuing. It's just weekly and it's ongoing, and welcome to season two, I guess.
Yeah, you can't get rid of us. We're here to stay. We're going to keep bringing and sharing the stoke.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Emily Holland.
And I'm Jonathan Ronzio. We'll catch you next week with another episode of the Stokecast.